I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend. India is the seventh largest economy in the world, and it's currently growing by about 7%. That's down from where it was a few years ago, but still a pretty healthy clip. But its history can be a little opaque to Westerners. Sunil Kilnani is changing that with a fascinating new book, and it's called Incarnations, A History of India in 50 Lives. He's picked 50 people whose lives represent the country's past and present, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
Why did you write this book, which is a history of India, but sort of through the snapshot of 50 different lives? Why'd you do it that way?
Well, two initial reasons. I mean, one, if you like, because Indians are overinvested in history. And by that, I mean in the myths about their history. But the other reason was because I think those outside of India are underinvested in Indian history. And let me just explain. I mean, at the moment in India, if you write things about historical figures, you can actually, your life can be in danger. There are libraries burnt down because people have written books based on their material on historical figures. So there's this great mythification of certain figures in Indian history, and it's very hard to tell the real stories about them. So partly I wanted to sort of demythologize in order to rehumanize figures in Indian history. On the other hand, in the West, there's very little knowledge about Indian history.
Mm. So I wanted to look at modern Indian history, and I wanted to start with Indira Gandhi and both the era of socialism and also kind of crony capitalism that she ushered in, and then the emergency. I'm going to ask you to explain what the emergency is, but let's talk about I guess she really sort of paved the way for the modern Indian economy.
Well, I think, I mean, Indira Gandhi is one of the most controversial figures in modern Indian history. But she's also a figure who left a huge imprint on Indian politics. She was prime minister for almost 18 years, 17 years. And she was the one who certainly challenged Indian democracy most seriously through this period called the emergency, when essentially democratic rights in the constitution were suspended. In a sense, it deepened the commitment to democracy because people realized what they were about to lose.
Mm.
You know, after the emergency, the participation in politics goes up. And she did also, I think, shape, as you say, she shaped the Indian economy in a curious way. I mean, she's ruling at a time when the Indian economy is not doing well. And so the state needs revenues. And it enters into these alliances and partnerships with private business in order to kind of make money off it. She made possible a certain kind of corruption, which became then, I think, endemic in the Indian economy through regulation. That's to say, if you had to get ahead in business, you had to get a license. It was basically a monopoly. And how did you get the license? By cultivating political influence and basically buying it.
Do you think that that still exists today?
It's much, much less so. I mean, I think still a lot of very important decisions in the Indian economy get decided at the political level, and those who have access to power still come out best. But it's no doubt true that in the last 25 years, the opening of the economy has taken a lot of power away from governments and from the state, but it's still not a completely level playing field.
The last essay that I want to talk about is the one you end with about Dhirubhai Ambani. There's a phrase in here when you say his most underrated talent was a gift for maximizing and monetizing inequality. What does that mean?
Well, what I'm getting at there is one of the things that he discovers very early, and this is a remarkable story. I mean, this is a completely self-made
Titan of industry.
Absolutely. I mean, he is the founder of the biggest corporate entity in India today. His son, Mukesh Ambani, is one of the richest men in the world. And this is a man, Dhirubhai Ambani, who as a teenager goes off to Aden to work as a migrant labor. And there he learns the importance of information. If you have a bit of information that no one else has, you can make your fortune. And that's particularly the inequality that I think he plays off on, because when he goes back to India, he goes back to this regulated world of the regulated economy of Mrs. Gandhi's era. And he realizes there that if you know what licenses are about to be made available, what deals are about to be struck at the political level, you can maximize your business opportunities. So it's that maximizing of inequalities of information that I think he then turns into an economic tool to make his fortune.
I mean, his son's house is, what, the most famous house in Mumbai? 27 stories?
Yeah, it's supposed to be the largest single private residence in the world with two helipads as well. But the amazing thing is, you know, when you see poor people in Mumbai standing outside it, they're not, you don't feel any anger or resentment. There's a kind of almost a sense of admiration and of hero worship. That the Ambanis are seen as kind of heroes of the republic for having made this their fortune.
Do you think you can say that his story, his son's stories, democratize Indian capitalism?
Well, what he did, what Dhirubhai did, was he made it acceptable in India to be wealthy. I think until that time, there was a kind of Gandhian frugality and austerity, Mahatma Gandhian frugality to India. And in that sense, that's why I end the book with Dhirubhai Ambani, because I think he marks the end of that era and the beginning of the era of, you know, let's all get rich.
To get a little personal, your wife, Kate Boo, a mentor and idol of mine.
And mine too.
To be clear. Wrote an incredible book, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, where she followed a number of people in a slum in Mumbai. And I guess I wonder, how do you take those lives, the people she spent so much time with, and get them to a place where, I'm not even talking about the middle class, I'm talking about where their lives are steady and stable. What kind of job needs to exist in the Indian economy for that to happen?
You know, that is such an important and difficult question. I think one of the things that Kate traces in her book is the kind of expansion of this temp job economy, that people are constantly hustling to get by and they don't know what work they're going to do from one week to the next or one day to the next. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why there's so much competition in India for government jobs, because government jobs, the public sector, is the only place that you can have a secure job. But of course, the irony is that that whole sector is shrinking. So the volatilities in the lives of the Indian poor are enormous. And there isn't, you know, there isn't one thing, I think, which is going to address them. But at the moment, for instance, the government is working really hard to bring more and more Indians into the financial system, into the banking system. And that's one step forward, I think, if Indians actually have bank accounts and get them away from the local moneylenders and that whole world. So I think those sorts of things are little steps in the right direction.
Sunil Kilnani, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to be on here.